hitched one on the way back over. And we got Joan here from Harrisonburg with us tonight to share. Please help me welcome Joan.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. I'm Joan. I'm an alcoholic. Don't worry. I'm not going to read you from the big book. It's like my security blanket. Every time I've spoken, I've taken it up to the podium with me. There are a few things that sometimes I've used and sometimes I never look at it. But I like to have it with me. So that being said, I have a sobriety date. It's October 27th, 2010. And that's not when I first tried to get sober, but that's when I finally got my last white chip. I have a home group right now. This is my second home group. Right now, my home group is a big book study group. We meet on Tuesday nights at the clubhouse in Harrisonburg at 8 p.m. Once a month, we have a speaker meeting like this, only we eat dinner first. So we eat dinner at 7:30 and then we speaker at 8. And that is the first Tuesday of the month. I have a sponsor. And I talk to her fairly regularly, not every day, but fairly regularly, sometimes more if I'm like, all like, but I do have a sponsor and she's been sponsoring me now for a while. So anyways, I'm going to try to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And I don't write anything down. When I first, the very first time I went to speak, I started writing out this thing and I was like, holy cow. I'll be like, we have a friend in the Elkton group, Rick, and he'll start to talk and share at a meeting and he jokes around. He'll say, it all started when I was 3 years old. We just love him. He's such a backwoods country boy, but we love him. So yeah, I don't know what made me an alcoholic. I do know that there were some difficulties in my family. I was born in Northern Indiana. I have two younger sisters. My parents divorced when I was about 12 years old, and there was a lot of fighting before that. And my sisters really don't remember this, but I remember my parents by then had, we three were upstairs and they were downstairs in their bedroom. And I remember hearing sometimes them yelling and then slapping. And I would be like coming down, like halfway down the stairs, worried, like, what's going to happen? And did I bring my water? Yes. Then, you know, I just remember that tension and I didn't really know what was going on. Now I kind of understand. It was both of them at the time. I blamed it all on my dad because he was the bigger guy, you know. But anyways, there were problems. And after the divorce, my mom was a single mom back then. I was born in 1960, so you can figure out how old I am. And back then, when at my age of 12 years old or whatever, we could run around town, do whatever we wanted to, ride your bike, whatever. And my mom was working like a part-time job sometimes at night, especially Friday and Saturday night. She worked at my aunt's bar as a waitress. And during the week, she worked at a factory. And so there were lots of times that we could, you know, sneak out or do what we wanted. And so I don't really remember my first drink. I just know it was like I'm not saying I didn't always feel like that I didn't fit in, but I always felt like weird, like I'm not part of the cool kids. I'm not a cheerleader. I tried the sports thing and I was okay at sports, but I definitely was not the sports freak because I wasn't willing to give myself all out, you know, die for that volleyball. No way. Especially in high school when by that time I'm already drinking. I'm like, this is not important enough. Sorry. I just remember that when I was like, I think around 14 years old, ended up at a party, and that's how I would drink when I was a teenager, at parties. where people older than me would have alcohol somehow. I didn't know how, I didn't care. It was, I thought it was fun. But I always drank to get drunk. And I, after I drank, I felt like I could fit in a little bit better. You know, that was fun. But, you know, I won't talk too long about that because basically I felt like I was just drinking like a regular teenager. Like, you know, like everybody did that. Like, and a lot of people smoke, you know, that wacky tobacco, and they did all that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, fairly normal, I thought. But I don't think now that I look back at it that I drank normal, because I drank to get drunk from the get-go. One time when I was younger, I remember, I'll just tell a couple of stories. I remember I was a teenager. I called my mom and I said, I'm going to spend the night at Angie's house. Well, that was bull, because I wasn't. I was at a party. And I don't know why I thought I could get this across, you know, when there's no cell phones then. So the noise is in the background, of course. And she's like, no, you get your A here and now. And I'm like, I can't. And finally, I got someone to take me home. And I was so drunk, I couldn't walk up the stairs. My mom had to help me up the stairs. And I don't know what she, later on when I talked to her about my alcoholism, she said that she thought I was just being a normal, you know, rebellious teenager. But it was more than that. But yeah, she then had to deal with me the next day. And the craziness is like, I think when I was about 16, my stepsister and I, and my stepfather, my mother had remarried by then to a man who was a drinker and used to beat her again. My dad didn't drink really, but they used to fight physical. And then she met this guy and they did the same thing. But anyways, we went on a vacation. We went to visit some old friends of his up in New York State. And I was bored. My stepsister and I were stuck back at the house while the adults went into town to go to the bar and drink. And I'm like, this sucks. We need to do something. So my stepsister, I made amends to her because I figured it was my fault. I drug her into town. But she said, I don't know. I was willing to do anything to get out of there. So anyways, we hitchhiked into a strange town. We're in a place we don't know. We hitchhike into town just so we can go find a place to party. Now, if that isn't crazy, I don't know what is. And I don't remember how we got back home. I think some guy that we met that was hooked us up with drinking and stuff took us there. I don't really remember what all happened that night. I know that I thought it was fun. That's why I did it. So I got married fairly young. I was smart though. I mean, I got good grades in high school. I think that's another reason that my mom just kind of let things slide under the radar, because I was smart. I could get good grades. I graduated with honors, all the while drinking, and I was off to college, but I hated it. I felt left out, alone. I didn't know anybody there. I just didn't want to be there. And my first husband, he came down there to see me one time and he said, I can't take this anymore. I'm moving back to Florida. We were in Indiana. I'm moving back to Florida and, you know, you'll probably never see me again. So I'm like, the logical thing to do is to quit school and move in with your boyfriend so you can party. And this is just no fun at all. And so that's what I did. I quit school. I moved in with him because I didn't want to lose the guy, and started partying. And we did what people that are like 18, 19 years old that are living together, just worked in factories and drank and did drugs and all that kind of fun stuff. And then the recession hit and we had to move to Florida to get a job. And so we got married. I think I did love him with a teenage kind of love, but it certainly wasn't a good thing for us to do what we did. But except for one wonderful thing came out of it, my daughter. I ended up pregnant. And I had this child, which I was so scared to death of raising this child. But I think that when I was around that age that I kind of became a binge drinker, because I could hold it together, because my first husband ended up finding out years later that he had paranoid schizophrenia, but he was not holding it together. So someone had to hold it together so we could pay the bills, get by, you know. And then I would go out on the weekends with the girls or whatever. One time when I was married to him, I went out with the girls. We came back and I was supposed to be the designated driver. Well, that didn't work out. My sister-in-law ended up driving us back because she only had a couple of drinks. And I was so drunk. We had a water bed. I had to lay on the floor. And because I knew if I laid on that water bed, I would be sick. So there was no way I was going. And then when my first husband, I did not know that he was already beginning his paranoid stuff, but he came out and was sure that I had been with a guy. So anyways, fast forward, I leave him because he won't get help. I move back to Indiana because that's where my parents are and that's where I can get help. And I don't do too bad. I drink and party on the weekends some, but I hold it together to keep a job and take care of my daughter. And so then I met my next husband, and I basically married him because I thought I needed to have a guy. I see that so often in so many women that are caught up in addiction, that is also another thing, addiction, that we feel like we need another person to validate us. And I guess I thought that because I married this guy. We went out, I got completely wasted on our first date. And I ended up marrying him just because he kept saying, well, if we don't get married, then I'm probably, you know, I'm not going to keep coming all the way the whole 10 miles from Elkhart to Goshen. I'm like, geez. Now that I think about it and look back on it, it's like, how ridiculous is that, that he would say that to me and I would believe that. But I did. And I just kept on drinking. So, but I was able to quit smoking in 1989. But this is the weird thing, how alcohol had a hold of me. When I decided to go back to pharmacy school in 1989, I knew I couldn't do drugs anymore because you get drug tested, okay? That's out, but alcohol is legal, right? So what's the problem? And so, and I also quit smoking cigarettes because I'm gonna be in the healthcare field. I need to be a healthier example. But I never crossed my mind that the drinking was a problem. So I did that. I quit smoking. It was hard, but I did. And then the drugs were not hard at all. I mean, they kind of scared me sometimes, the way that I could just feel like that attracted me. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not going there. But the alcohol had me in its grips by then. And so I was still drinking. I went to college. I went through 6 years of school to be a pharmacist, and I did good. And I still drank, especially every Friday and Saturday night. But there was a time there that I stopped drinking for 6 months. I was in my pre-pharmacy classes, and I was working as part-time as a waitress and going to school during the day. And at this bar/restaurant, there was this bartender that, and we all used to stay after work and have some drinks. And then one time he invited us all to his house for some more drinks after the after work drinks. And I went and I ended up sleeping with him. I ended up having an affair with this guy. I have no idea why. That goes completely against anything that I would think of, even then. And it was really pretty crazy. It was really pretty crazy then. And yeah, it was just, let's just say it was pretty crazy. But I got caught. And when I got caught, my husband said to me, you know, I'll let you stay if you quit that job and you never see him again, you know. And I told him, and he wanted me to quit drinking. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I did for about 6 months. I don't exactly know how long it was, but we were still living in South Bend, and I was doing my pre-pharmacy stuff at this, basically a community college. And then we had to move to West Lafayette, Indiana for Purdue to go to pharmacy school. And the first about year I was there, he was still working up in Elkhart, living at his mom's, and I was living down there, and he would come down on weekends. And so after about, you know, 6 months of not drinking, and then by then I'm down there by myself with my daughter, but without him there all the time. And he didn't even come every weekend. And so I started drinking again. And when he confronted me with it, he was pretty good at being, you know, codependent. So when he confronted me with it, I said, you know, I'm drinking at home. It'll be fine. I'm not going to go to the bars. I won't, you know, I won't do any of that. And so he just let it go. So then I continued. And after I graduated from there, we moved to Virginia. So now here I am in this beautiful state. And I'm getting ready to start this career that I thought was going to make everything okay. It didn't make everything okay. Finally, after about, I don't know, 5 years of working in that career, we were able to buy a house. And I thought that was going to make everything okay. It didn't. And by then, my daughter has moved out. She's an adult. She's moved out. And I'm stuck at home with this man who I don't know why I'm here. And I'm now drinking almost every night. And especially if I don't have to go to work the next day, I really drink. And my drink of choice is rum. I was telling Irene on the way over here, I never liked beer. It made me throw up. And I didn't much care for wine. It took too long. I mean, I had to drink too much. It was ridiculous. I was like, I always hated it. It used to be that the liquor stores closed, you know, they were closed on Sundays. I think they're open now. And they close, I don't know what time they close at night now, but they always close at 9. And I worked, my shift was 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And so I always had to make sure I had enough in advance to be able to have a few drinks when I got home from work, because by then the liquor store is closed. And so that went on. That was pretty miserable drinking for quite a number of years. So we moved, I don't know all my years. We moved to Virginia in 1995. So it just got worse and worse over those years. And I just got more and more miserable. I was drinking alone in the office away from him because I didn't really like him anymore. And he had his own issues, and I won't talk about them, but you know, they were issues that he's never been willing to work on. And so anyways, I'm drinking alone. There's no kid at home anymore. I don't have to worry about that. So all I have to do is keep my job and pay the bills and that kind of thing. And I could do that for some reason. I could do that. And but it finally came down. I was just so miserable. I hated myself. I hated my life. I didn't want people to get to know me at church. My ex-husband talked me into going to church with him. So I'll talk a little bit about that. I hope I'm not going all over the place, but it's just whatever comes out, comes out. So after we bought our house, which is I think in 2001, we started going to this church down the road, which he knew some people that went there. And I started to notice that the people at the church, they were all really very nice people and everything. They all had most of them had this sense of contentment and joy in their lives. And I thought, how did they get that? How do they get that? And at the time I was agnostic, and I had told my ex-husband, I said, I'll go to church with you, but I won't sing their songs and I'm not praying their prayers because I don't believe in their God. And he was like, that's fine. I just want you to go once in a while, keep me company. And I'm like, okay. So God works in mysterious ways, because apparently he was already working on me, getting me to Virginia, getting me to that church, getting me to live where I was living. I ended up, we got a pastor there who lived three houses down from us. him and his wife became very good friends of mine. So anyways, I start going to this church and I start noticing peace and contentment that I want and that I can't find in my life because I'm miserable. I'm drinking. I'm trying to hide it. Not really hide it completely from my husband, but hide it enough so that he doesn't know how much I'm drinking. So, you know, that thing of like, I buy a big bottle because it's more economical. And actually near the end, I started buying the cheaper rum instead of the Bacardi. But, and then I put it in little pint bottles in different places so that he doesn't know I'm going to the kitchen all the time to get the rum. So yeah, I'm just like, can pour some more in there and he won't know because I just went into the bedroom to do something. And that's what I'm thinking anyways. He doesn't know how much I'm drinking. And I have these big glasses that for a long time after I got sober, I had to put them up in a cupboard and not look at them. But I had these big glasses and that way I could say, I only had one drink. And, you know, so what if it's 24 ounces, you know, and half of it's rum. But anyways, that rationalization will, yeah, definitely kept me drunk for a long time. So as I started to notice that, dinging on the computer. as I started to notice their peace and serenity, I wanted that. And so I started attending church more often. And a lady there started talking to me, and she offered to do Bible study with me, which I'm not sure why I agreed to do this because I was still having a hard time believing in this God. And I said yes. And so we started, and we actually use a book about a part of the Bible, which I don't remember what it's called now, but we used that and I studied with her and I started to believe that there was a God there. And I thought, this must be why they're all happy and this is going to save me. So that was my first attempt to get sober, was after I started to come to believe in God, I thought, okay, God's going to get me sober. This is what I need. And I did all that Bible study and I went and talked to the pastor and his wife and got ready to be baptized. So I got baptized, I think it was in 2005. I got baptized and it just ended up happening to be on my birthday. That year I got baptized and I thought this was going to fix me. And it didn't. And I was so disappointed. And one night, one late afternoon or early evening, my ex-husband came into the room and I was crying. And he's like, what's wrong? What are you so upset about? And I said to him, I just thought that, you know, after getting baptized and joining the church that I'd be able to quit drinking. And he said, well, it doesn't say anywhere in the Bible that you can't drink. They had wine in the Bible. It's fine. You don't need to worry about it. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I stopped trying. It wasn't working anyway. So all it did was make me more miserable. You know, I'm sure that a lot of you know that feeling of, I really just think I need to quit drinking, but I don't know how. So I tried that. And then I tried more exercise. I think it talks about that a little bit in the big book, all the different ways that we try. I mean, I didn't try the no drinking of beer or wine or whatever all that stuff is, but I did try lots of different ways. And one of them was to get more exercise and because I thought I need to lose weight. And so, and it worked for a while. I mean, I was able to cut back for a while because I was exercising in the morning. I was making myself get up early and gone and on and on. And then I congratulated myself by, you know, drinking more. I didn't ever really go on some of those binges I hear people talk about, but because I just drank at home and I didn't have to go out anywhere. So I would just, you know, middle of the night, my ex-husband would sometimes wake up and find me passed out on the computer table in front of the computer. That's what I did. Or I'd go to bed and wake up in the morning and I'd be like, oh, I still have all my clothes on. I didn't get undressed and get into bed. I just passed out. So I tried lots of different things. And then I tried therapy. And I've done therapy before when I've been drinking, for marriage therapy and all this kind of stuff. So I was trying therapy again for myself. And I don't know why, but with this therapist, was the first time that I'd ever been honest about how much I drank. I never told the doctors how much I drank, because they always ask those questions and you're always like, yeah, I have a few drinks here and there. But for some reason, after I'd gotten to know her for a while, I don't remember the exact words, but I became honest about how much I drank. So she suggested that I come to AA. And I said, I can't. And she said, why not? And I said, because I have a very public job and I don't think that, you know, I could run into someone in the meeting and they could be one of my customers. And next thing you know, nobody's going to trust me. Everybody's going to know. She's like, well, I think their anonymity thing is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Well, I was like, no, I can't do that. So she's like, well, what else would you like to try? So we tried this neurofeedback type thing, or what was it? You put things on your head and then you try to calm your brain by looking at this computer and listening to this music. It didn't work, because I always had my therapy sessions, of course, on my day off, because I had 12-hour shifts. And of course, since it was going to be my day off, I always drank more the night before. And so I come in, you know, to my therapy session at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be hungover, and there's no quieting of the mind at all. It didn't work. So I did that for a while, but it wasn't working. So I finally said, okay, I'll go to AA, kind of like I did when I said, okay, I'll go to church. I went reluctantly. And that was in the summer of 2009. If you remember, my sobriety date's not until 2010, because I didn't want to listen to all you people. You know, you told these stories about being in the gutter, DUIs, not everybody, but enough that I was like, man, you people are really bad. I have never had a DUI. I don't know why not. I've driven drunk. I have never been in jail. Well, no, I can't say I've never been in jail. I was in jail once when I was 18. They arrested us for drugs. So never been in jail for alcohol. I had all these things that, you know, and I didn't listen to the fact that I don't know if I heard the thing about comparing in instead of comparing out, because that's what I was doing. I was comparing out. I was like, I was basically like a lady by the name of Donna came up to me after my first meeting. You need to get this book. You need to get this book. And I'm a reader. I can read. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I get the books. I think I got Living Sober and the Big Book. And so basically what I did was I came to meetings once in a while. I got myself a little notebook. And that's how the only reason I know that I went to meetings that summer, it was the summer of 2009, is because I did write a few notes, because I saw other people doing that. And I thought, well, that must be what you need to do to get sober. And, but I didn't want to put all the other work into it. I'm busy. I have a job, a full-time job. I don't have time. So I'm reading some, but I'm not really getting a sponsor. And so I don't know how many white chips I got that year. I do remember some specific times that I went back out drinking. And one of them was in the spring of 2010 when my mom almost died. I went to Florida and she was really in a bad way and we thought she was gonna die. And I had not told any of my other family besides my ex-husband that I was trying to quit drinking. So when they all went out to dinner and they all had their drinks, I had drink too. And I started drinking. actually, now go back in the fall of 2009, I started drinking once when we went to Bonaire. I almost forgot about that scuba diving trip. How can you stay sober on a scuba diving trip? That's what I thought. All these people are drinking. That was like allowed to drink by lunchtime because, you know, you've already scuba dived. You had your lunch. You can do whatever you want on the island. Including getting lost. I got drunk one day and my ex-husband pissed me off because he fell asleep and didn't want to go do anything else. And so I was like, oh, the heck with you. I'm going to get in this rental car and I'm just going to drive and go see stuff. And I got lost because I was drunk and I wasn't paying attention, but I did luckily find my way back. But when I got back, you know, I picked up a white chip and tried it again. But after my mom almost died and I came back, I did not pick up a white chip. I did not tell anybody. I didn't call. I had a sponsor in name and I didn't call her anymore. And I showed up at meetings once in a while. I don't know why, I guess just to save face, because some people had gotten to know me by then. You know, it'd been almost a year. And some people, especially in particular, Raymond Rhodes, who has passed away, so I can use his last name. This man would come to my pharmacy just to check up on me. I didn't really know that until later, when I got sober, but I would see him every now and then. I thought, oh God, there's somebody from the group. They're going to see me. They're going to ask me, why haven't I been to meetings? Oh my God, leave me alone. And I found out later when he became one of my best friends that he was checking up on me. He was trying to look out for me. He was just showing his face, I guess, in case something would nudge me. So I was so afraid to pick up that white chip when I had been basically lying to everybody. And I wasn't going to do it. I was just so afraid. And so I didn't know what to do until I went to a meeting one night and I heard a man share that he had done the same thing. I thought it was unique. I thought it was the only one that lied, drank, and went to meetings. My ex-husband said, why are you going to those meetings if you're still drinking? I said, I don't know. I'm trying. You know, I usually put on the tears whenever I wanted sympathy. So finally, after I heard him, I was like, oh my gosh, I really need to do this. And so I did. I got honest. I picked up my last white chip, which I'm glad it was my last white chip. And I cried so much at the end of that meeting. And so I knew I needed to do what you people told me to do. So I bought the 12 and 12. I got a sponsor, a different sponsor, because I was too embarrassed to ask Laura, sweet, sweet Laura, who died of cancer at the age of 50. Oh my goodness. So many people I have met and loved over the years now. Anyways, I digress. I just loved her to death. Even though I didn't ask her to be my sponsor again, because I was too embarrassed. So I asked this other lady who seemed like she had time. I mean, she had enough sober time, but I mean, she seemed like she had time for me. And she said, yes, of course. And we started working on the steps. You know, I told you guys that I'd already come to believe in God, but I did not think God believed in me. And I say this a lot. I share that a lot in meetings, because that's why I just couldn't turn it over to God. And sometimes I still have trouble turning everything over to my higher power, because I think I can control it. The only thing I had under control at that picnic was my sloppy joes. Because I told my sponsor, I said, everything's under control. And I told her that like the Tuesday before, and she just gave me the eye. And I said, my sloppy joes are under control. But, you know, I had to let go of the outcome of that, but it was great. Anyways, so I started working the steps with this sponsor, and I started really doing what you people suggested. I listened. I listened in meetings. I started to identify in. I think I was a little while sober before I actually heard a lady tell her story that was very similar to mine. And she's, I have her phone number in my phone, but she lives in Waynesboro. I don't see her very often, but she's a friend of mine. I can say that almost anybody in AA is a friend of mine, of course, but anyways, I finally heard that. But as I started working the steps, I started to realize that my higher power was working behind the scenes all this time. I could just see that what I always had attributed as coincidences were not. They were my higher power working to get me to where I needed to be. And some of those things were really painful, because sometimes I have to get to really, you know, go through really painful things to get to where I need to be. And I heard a speaker online one time talking about, you know, why do some people get this and some people don't? And this guy said that he used to always say, thanks to the grace of God, I'm here, sober and alive. And then after speaking one time, he talked to someone who was just crying, and she was, you know, she was telling him that her brother just died of this disease. And he's like, she was like, well, I don't understand why the grace of God wasn't there for her, for him. And I just really like his explanation of this was that the grace of God was there for him. He just wasn't ready to accept it. And sometimes we just have to be made ready to accept it. And I don't know that I wasn't completely ready to turn everything over to my higher power, even after I got sober, because at 11 months sober, having never lost a job because of my alcoholism, I lost my job. I had my job for 16 years at the same place. I was fired. Not because I made a mistake or because I was drunk at work, but because I was a big total, I'm not going to say it, that word, at work. I would come in hungover. The first year of sobriety was terrible. I was so, my emotions were up, down, up, down. And I would come in and somebody would say something to me. And I don't know if anybody ever worked in the public, but it's really hard sometimes. And they would say something to me and I would tell them what they could do with it in no uncertain terms, even sober, because I was just, after I got sober, I knew I was on thin ice at work. I would pray every day, God, please don't let me say anything. One more time came and they fired me. And I thought my world was going to end. I thought it was going to end. But I didn't think I was going to drink. I was 11 months sober. I didn't want to get another white chip. I went home and laid on my bed and cried. My ex-husband was at a loss what to do. He called the pastor. He came down and talked to me. So then I calmed down and I set up to talk to him. And he says to me, okay, so what are you going to do? And I said, I'm calling my sponsor. Finally, I'd been trained to do what I need to do. I called my sponsor. She said, I'll meet you at the 5:30 meeting. And I went to a meeting and I cried. And I cried. And I was unemployed for 6 months. That was a lesson in humility that I'll never forget. I stayed sober. My sponsor had me make a list of things I needed to do. I went to more meetings. I went to 2 meetings a day because I'm looking for a job, but that's pretty much all online, right? I'm looking for a job and I'm doing what I need to do. Someone in AA told me, file for unemployment. I said, what? I got fired. How do you get unemployment when you get fired? Just do it. You don't know. I did it. I got unemployment. I didn't think I would, but I did. And it wasn't that much, but it was better than nothing. And we made it through that with the help of friends and AA. And I stayed sober. That was the most important thing. By then, I'd already joined a home group, which was the recovery group then. And I really got active. Long after I lost my job, they were like, oh, well, you have time. You could be our GSR. You have time. Okay. All right. I'll do that. What's that? The general service representative. Okay. Whatever that is. I got to go to an assembly and I learned a lot, I learned about how people can argue about something, then, you know, give a hug afterwards because they're on opposite sides of this issue, but they're all staying sober together. So, you know, everything was fine. So my journey in sobriety has definitely been a journey. At about 2 years sober, my ex-husband, he had his own issues. I don't think he does this anymore, but I caught him huffing aerosol inhalant, and he had passed out because he tried to use a bag over his head to enhance the high. And I was so mad. I was gonna divorce him right then. But I didn't. I went to a lawyer and I found out how much it was going to cost me. And I thought, well, I don't know, maybe I can make this work. Because by then he was so disabled, he couldn't work. He had been self-employed for so long. He didn't have any credits for disability. And he was so overweight and so in such bad physical shape that he couldn't work. And I was going to have to pay alimony. And I said, oh, okay. Well, so we tried counseling, we tried different things, and it just wasn't working. And I think I just needed to stay sober longer to be able to figure all that out. So, you know, I didn't divorce him until I think it was 2017. Now it's been a little while. But it was amicable. I learned, like, I talked to everybody. Well, not everybody, but, you know, my sponsor, my daughter, my sisters, my girlfriends in AA, all these people, I was like, okay, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And I do that with most of my major decisions nowadays, especially when it comes to involving emotions like that. Do you think I'm really crazy? Or do you think that's a crazy idea? Or, you know, those kind of things. And it took me like 3 months of soul searching to decide, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And we did it like two adults, really. We went to mediation and we split everything. And, you know, I got to pay a bunch of alimony, but that's just the way it is. You know, I'm much happier now that I'm not in that codependent relationship. I never had a sober relationship before, and that's really important to me now. I have a sober relationship now with a man, and everything is based on honesty. And that's what one of the things of this program is, you know, the how is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And in order for me to get completely sober, I had to become completely honest. My sponsor knows a lot of stuff about me that I, you know, that I don't choose to share in these kind of talks. But if a woman one-on-one, you know, needs help, I might share something, you know, more intimate. But, you know, she knows, you know, pretty much everything. And so that honesty and then open-mindedness, I'm still working on that. I'm more open-minded than I was before. But I am amazed. Eric is my fiance, and we will be somewhere. We were at my daughter's for my grandson's graduation, and they're on the opposite side of the political spectrum as we are. But my fiance, Eric, was able to sit there and watch their news program and come away from it saying, you know, he actually had some good points. And I'm like, okay. I was not even wanting to listen because he was my opposite of my point of view. And so I am still working on that open-mindedness. I'm open-minded to a lot of things that have to do with recovery now, but there's still some things that I'm just like, oh no, I've already made up my mind about that. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if anybody else struggles with that, but I still struggle with that. And the willingness, though, I have the willingness now. I have the willingness to work on these things, to At my last job, I had a really difficult person that I worked with. And, you know, I would go to my sponsor and she'd be like, well, you know, there's a prayer in the fourth step. And I'm like, what? A prayer in the fourth step? I didn't know there was a fourth step prayer. She's like, yeah, there's a fourth step prayer. I was like, oh. And I don't remember exactly where it is. I pointed that out to a sponsee recently, and it basically says, God, help me to see how this person is also sick and help me to try to understand that person as I would a sick friend, or, you know, basically another sick person in AA, where this person, you know, was not in recovery, was someone I worked with, and I thought that he was just an asshole. Sorry. But I have to look at what I had done, and I had done some things in response instead of reactions, instead of responding sensibly. Sometimes I just reacted to what he did, and I had to look at that. And then she pointed me back into this story back here in Acceptance is the Answer. And she's like, oh, and I was like, oh yeah, I love that story, that acceptance part. She said, no, I want you to read the part where they talk about having the glasses on wrong. I was like, oh, like I was so familiar with the part where it says acceptance is the answer to all my problems, that I wasn't paying attention to the part that's where he talks about when he looks at another person, he needs to be looking at himself instead of that person's faults. Basically, when he's saying that the glasses are on backwards. So, you know, at least I'm willing to. Oh, okay. Yeah, I see your point. Because every time I talk about somebody else causing my problems, my sponsor points out to me that one finger pointing out means there's three pointing back, and that the problem is probably in me, because I still have a lot of issues that I have to work on. We spent a long time working on the step 6 and 7, because after we did the steps, my sponsors are big on working through reading lots of different things. We did the steps, then we did the traditions, then we did the big book up through the first 164 pages. And then we did Drop the Rock. And I know that's not an AA approved book, but I like it. And it does say we can use outside sources, resources. So we used that to help me more deeply understand 6 and 7, because it does seem like it's kind of a skipped over steps right there in the big book. It's like, oh, there's 6 and there's 7. Oh yeah, move on. And that's kind of what I did the first time I did the steps. I really didn't. And I'm not saying that's a terrible, terrible thing, because, you know, we moved on and I got through steps 8 and 9. And when I did step 9, that was when I felt the first time when I did step 9, that was when I felt the real first belonging in AA and the real first relief. Because I went to another person that I had worked with whom I had not been very nice to, very nice lady. And I had refused to adjust my schedule to help her out when she was pregnant, because my time was too important back when I was drinking. And when I went to make my amends with her, she said, I'm really glad that you're doing well, but I don't, and I think, you know, that you're a nice person overall, but I could never work with you again. And, you know, that actually, I left there and I was so elated. I was like, I thought that went really well, even though she said I could never work with you again. I was like, oh, that's okay. I understand. I don't like working with me sometimes too. So that is definitely an okay thing. But I felt such a relief. And then as I worked through those, I felt a lot of relief. But today, my life is really good. You know, work is still tough. It's still a four-letter word to me. It's gotten really hard with the pandemic. And I know other people in healthcare have felt that. But I'm hanging in there. I'm trying to do the best I can with that. But the rest of my life is just like so much joy in that, you know, we can go, like after we left the picnic yesterday, we heard from Irene that they were doing something downtown. So I'm like, okay, let's just go stop downtown and see. And they're doing all these little kid things. So we're walking around and I saw Snoopy. And I was like, Snoopy! There was a Snoopy there. And if you donate money for their animal shelter or whatever, you get your picture taken with Snoopy. I was ecstatic. It's these little things in life that just, you know, and then the beauty of the area and just, you know, just getting to live and enjoy things today is a big deal to me. And I have such close friends. Jerry, who is my best friend, she's like 12 years older than me. And as it says in the big book, normally we would never have mixed. But she just keeps me in stitches. And she's been sober a long time. And I just love her to death. So, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. But I'm run out of time. And so I hope I had said something that will be helpful to someone somewhere. Thanks.